To call to order the Health and Human Services Committee in the Senate for Wednesday, February 29th. We have four bills to hear today. We do not yet have a quorum, but we will begin testimony, and first we'll take up Senate File 1861, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 1861 is a request to allow medical assistants to pay out-of-state residential mental health treatment for children who are deaf or hard of hearing and use American Sign Language as their primary means of communication. These children, when they are diagnosed with a need for inpatient mental health services, go to a facility here in Minnesota, but then have added interpreter costs that can be thousands of dollars a day, depending on the level of care that they need. This is done to facilitate communication with counselors, physicians, and other members of the facility staff. There are specialized facilities across the nation that provide this service for 14 other states. Negotiated rates there are $500 a day on average. And we've had a fiscal note drafted on this bill. There's no fiscal impact to the state, but we believe it would ultimately result in a savings to our state and county. I have here with me Shanna Gassman and Dr. Rebecca Goffman, who would like to give the committee some testimony.
All right, thank you. I have on my list, is it Gassner, G-A-S-N-E-R? So please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Gassner. I work at Fernbrook Family Center in Owatonna.
Could I ask you to bring a microphone up close so that we can hear your testimony and record it for posterity?
My name is Sheena Gassner. I work at Fernbrook Family Center in Owatonna. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thanks for being here.
Sorry. I'm a social worker, and in 2011, I was given a referral for targeted children's mental health case management for a young man who attended Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. He had received a cochlear implant and relied primarily on this and lip reading until he began attending MSAD. He'd been communicating in American Sign Language for only 2 years of his life. He was not just a student at MSAD. He also received services from the IMPACT program. That's an intensive outpatient mental health program that's located on the campus of the state school and operated by Volunteers of America. This program was developed to serve those children requiring additional therapeutic and behavioral supports who are deaf, deaf-blind, and hard of hearing. Despite this, he was struggling in the educational setting. He was assaultive to school personnel, absconded from the facility, engaged in high-risk behaviors, and damaged property. His behaviors were impacting his academic and therapeutic success. Social interaction and communication was a significant struggle both in hearing and deaf relationships and in his family. He was unfamiliar with the deaf culture. As I mentioned, he had only known sign language for 2 years. His mother, too, had only been signing for 2 years, and his father did not know sign. He didn't have any relationships in the dorms, and he didn't have them at home, and this led to frustration and a decline. He had about 6 trips to the emergency room in a period of 4 months. He engaged in extremely high-risk behaviors, assaulted his mother, and threatened a neighborhood peer. His school placement was in jeopardy due to his behaviors. As a social worker, I was told there were no adequate services in the state of Minnesota. Being a bit stubborn, I was unable to take this at face value. Over the next month, I spent many hours researching and subsequently corresponding via phone and email to obtain the appropriate services. I located the placement that I felt was going to serve his needs best in Florida. As a parent of a similar age child, I first addressed this barrier with the family. They amazingly made the arrangements for his dad to quit his job and to go live with an acquaintance in Florida, so they felt safe letting their young man receive services that he needed so far from home. The county agreed to cover additional costs, but medical assistance would not cover the therapeutic services. I realized that this was not an inexpensive proposition. Initially, I was quoted $750 per diem for the National Deaf Academy. All of their staff are fluent in ASL and have extensive experience working with deaf youth. The facility was willing to negotiate a lower per diem rate for the state of Minnesota. I contacted every department within DHS that I thought even remotely was connected with what I needed for this student. I contacted medical assistants repeatedly, as well as the Office of the Ombudsman. I continued to hear this wasn't possible, that due to a statute, it just couldn't happen. His behaviors were escalating, and I felt forced to look at options that were less than ideal within the state. An inpatient residential mental health treatment facility for youth in Duluth stepped up and agreed to meet his needs as best they could. An intake meeting was arranged to start the process and develop an understanding of what these services would look like. They were thoughtful enough to ask the Duluth Public School District to join us for this meeting. The representative from the school district suggested he receive 24-hour-a-day interpretation services. I thought, this is unnecessary. Why would he need this when he's sleeping? Then I realized that he frequently misunderstood what was being said unless he had sign language interpreters present. I understood that despite the cochlear implants, he was unable to decipher the words he was hearing. And began to think, what if there's a fire or a tornado? How do they communicate this to him from a sleeping state? What do you suppose 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week interpretation services cost? On the low side, a sign language interpreter costs $50 an hour. They would need two interpreters. This would come to a cost of $1,800 to $3,200 a day. We're in a recession. The state budget's in the red. Services for individuals with mental illness are being cut left and right. The most cost-effective solution is to have specialized inpatient treatment services of this kind to be covered by MA. The average rate negotiated by states for NDA is $500 a day. The cost would be lower, and the children would get the appropriate services that they need. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gassner. Are there any questions for this witness? Then we would like to hear from our additional witness. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Dr. Rebecca Goffman, and I work for Volunteers of America.
Thank you. Dr. Goffman, please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would like to thank Senator Benson for introducing this important piece of legislation and allowing me to testify to support 1861, which will allow medical assistants to pay for out-of-state, culturally affirmative inpatient mental health care. I'm Dr. Rebecca Goffman. I'm a teacher and psychologist who has had the privilege of working with and learning from the deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind community for over 20 years. As a mental health professional, I have seen hundreds of kids with hearing loss successfully manage symptoms of anxiety and depression and other disorders with typical outpatient therapy. There have been three or four who have needed inpatient care because their symptoms have caused them to be unsafe. Minnesota does not currently have a program that effectively meets their needs. To fully understand the importance of providing culturally affirmative mental health services to children who use ASL, try to imagine yourself, a hearing person at your worst moment in life, being sent to a mental health institution where everyone around you is deaf, ASL is the only language used to communicate, and all treatment decisions are made through a deaf lens. Imagine trying to learn from your therapist or your peers or the support staff when communication is limited to basic gestures like when you play charades, or the ability of an interpreter to get the full message across. Would you trust your therapist to fully understand your needs? Would you be willing to try new things? Could you effectively participate in learning groups? I doubt it. In fact, it is more likely that feelings of frustration and oppression would worsen your symptoms and make it harder for you to manage. In truth, yourselves hearing and resilient, you would probably try to learn sign language and integrate yourself into that therapeutic community so you could get the most out of it. It would take longer for you to succeed, but you could do it. In the case of a child with hearing loss, no matter how resilient he is, he will never have the option of learning how to use his ears and effectively communicate in spoken English. As a mental health professional, I am increasingly being asked to apply evidence-based practices to improve outcomes. The goal is to provide the best care in the least restrictive environment for the least cost. As you can see from the above example, the only way to do that is through culturally affirmative care. Understanding how hearing loss can affect development across a broad range of areas is imperative because it influences everything from diagnosis to treatment planning to even aftercare recommendations. A therapeutic environment that embraces deaf culture inherently enhances the deaf client's ability to fully benefit from the program, necessarily improve outcomes, and increase or integrates the child back into their natural environment in a more timely and cost-effective way. Thank you for listening to my testimony. Please vote yes to change the state statute to include MA coverage for out-of-state inpatient services for deaf and hard of hearing children.
Thank you, Dr. Goffman. And I do want to note that we have quorum. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. If there are no further questions, then I move Senate File 1861 be recommended to pass and go directly to the floor.
All right. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Benson, this bill seems to target a very specific small group of children. Can you explain to me why or what is the reasoning behind that?
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman. There is a small intersect between children who are hard of hearing and children who have mental illness. Children who have mental illness but are otherwise able, do not have a hearing or blindness impediment, can be treated in our traditional inpatient facilities here in the state. But communication is critically important to mental health recovery and positive results. And so getting them to a facility where they can communicate in a way that is natural for them is critical to their having a good outcome.
I know what's
happening. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I was wondering if there were any restrictions on how far away from Minnesota or anything like that. But I see in the last line that the state has to be a member of the Interstate Compact on Mental Health. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I am not familiar with the specifics of the Interstate Compact.
Looks like we have somebody here who can present some testimony on that. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Higgins, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. In 2009, legislation was passed that allowed border states to provide services to children in the state of Minnesota for inpatient treatment. That, I believe, was prompted by the ease for parents to be able to get to those facilities and also the cost factor for transportation, et cetera. So they are part of the Interstate Compact. This would allow them to, and there's very specific guidelines, regulations. The state has to, you know, examine the facility, make sure it meets the standards of the state. And so they would have to meet those specific standards that the other border states have had to meet, and they would be included in those in order to be able to receive MA coverage.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Senator Benson or the witnesses? Seeing none, we have a motion. Senator Benson moves Senate File 1861 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Benson and witnesses. Next, I'd like to take up 753, Senate File 753, Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen, what would you like to begin with?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 573 is a bill to modify the social worker license requirements.
And
the
753.
Goal, 753. What did I say? Got it wrong here. Okay, she's starting off real good here. The goal of this bill of 753, Mr. Chair and members, is to ensure that there is an equal and increased protection standards for consumers, and it creates a consistent public policy going forward. Currently, an individual who is calling himself a social worker doesn't necessarily have to have a social worker licensure. So it creates an even playing field with the city and originally the county, the state, and private nonprofits that have a focus on minority ethnic populations that are being served. This bill would include the licensed social worker, the licensed graduate social worker, the licensed independent social worker, and the licensed independent clinical social worker. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 delete all amendment, please.
We can treat this as an author's amendment. Okay. Title 783, but it is for 753. So Senator Rosen, as an author's amendment, moves the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an amendment that has been heavily worked on. As your handout shows, there has been 17 stakeholder meetings on this bill. It's been a bill that been heavily negotiated, and it's hopefully non-controversial that we know of to date right now. It does exempt the county worker out of this bill, so you just now have the city, the state, and the private nonprofits with focus on the minority populations, ethnic populations. I'll get back to this, the reasons why it's exempting the county worker, but it also, this amendment also extends the grandfathering clause for the licensure from 1 to 2 years, so they'll be starting in 2013 to 2014. It includes the title and practice protection and regulation for the social worker, because the social worker is a title and it's a professional domain, such as nursing or a paramedic. It also amends the prospective licensing, so there's no displaced workers. The individuals that will be newly employed up to 2016 then have to get a licensure. So if a title of a social worker is being used, they need to be licensed from that point on. So it creates a consistent public policy going forward, and that's what we have. Right here with me, Mr. Chair members, I have Ms. Kate Zacher-Pate, who has been involved in all these negotiations going forward, and I'd like to have her testify.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, and good morning. My name is Kate Zacher-Pate, and
I ask you just to spell your last name for us?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My last name is spelled Z-A-C-H-E-R hyphen, capital P as in Paul, A-T-E.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Social Work, and I would just first like to say that I so appreciate all Senator Rosen's work in moving this bill forward, and really thank all of the committee members as well today for allowing the board this opportunity to bring forward a bill that we have been working on so diligently for over a six-year period. Senator Rosen provided an amazing background for you, and I guess I would just highlight a couple of things, and certainly I would take questions. Just to be very clear again, the Board of Social Work's mission is to ensure public protection for the citizens of Minnesota who are receiving services from social workers. Licensing of social workers has been in effect in Minnesota since 1987. Senator Rosen mentioned the four licenses that the board does enforce. There's a bachelor's license, a graduate license, and two independent licenses as well. What is very important, too, is that all of these licenses certainly have requirements, which include education, national examination, supervised practice, continuing ed, ethical standards of practice, and we also require BCA background checks on all of our applicants. The board has worked also very, very hard to maintain and even reduce our licensing fees, which I think is important for the committee to be aware of. We have been able to reduce our fees and sustain that reduction by 30% since 2006. And our 24-month licensing fees range from $81 for a two-year period for the bachelor's license up to $238 for a two-year period for the independent clinical license. They are very low licensing fees in the state of Minnesota. A little more background, and then I will just mention a couple of other specifics. What's important to know is that when the Social Work Practice Act was originally introduced in 1987, there were a number of groups that were exempted from the mandatory licensing requirements, and we have already made some very good progress, and that's what brings us back today. We're hoping to continue that process. In the mid-90s, the exemption for hospital social workers, nursing home social workers, and school social workers was removed. And so really the board has been focusing on this as a continued goal with the remaining exemptions. And again, the bill that we're bringing forward today, as Senator Rosen mentioned, is really to provide consistent public policy and equal protection for consumers in the state of Minnesota. And by that, we would hope to include standards to allow access for those consumers to the board's complaint resolution process, which they don't have at this point if an individual is not licensed. Our bills were introduced last year. We were not heard in the Senate. So we are so delighted to be here this session. We were heard in the House both last session and this session. And what is important to note is that the House bill has been amended as well. And that is the bill, kind of a matching bill that is before you today in this A2 amendment. The amended bill has bipartisan support. It is non-controversial that we are aware of. And it's important, I think, for you to be aware also that the bill is overwhelmingly supported by MAPE, the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees Labor Union, by consumer advocacy groups and social work professionals. And again, important to note that this bill would modify the exemptions for city agencies, state agencies, and the private nonprofit agencies who have that specialized primary service focus serving ethnic minority populations. There is no change in this amendment to the current county exemption, and that would continue to exist. And essentially, I guess, to sort of summarize and conclude, the board is really, really aware that it needs to be conscious of trying to balance the regulation of licensed professionals with the needs of the marketplace while providing its mission of public protection. Senator Rosen mentioned some of the key provisions in this bill that I think get to that goal. The licensing requirements apply prospectively to new hires as of 2016. This bill would not displace workers. This bill does not limit an agency's ability to hire individuals that they deemed competent. If that individual that they wanted to hire had an academic training different than a social work degree, that would be perfectly acceptable. Does not interfere with licensing regulations whatsoever, as long as that person would not use the title of social worker. I think, in fact, this bill really would also build a more diverse workforce. I think this bill could also help to reduce the current disparities that exist in this state, and would allow greater access to individuals, to licensed professionals. And this bill has been repeatedly mentioned to the board that it really is seen as a value added for agencies, for workers, and for consumer organizations. This bill also includes two housekeeping provisions. It makes a correction to include a temporary license provision that was inadvertently omitted from our statutory recodification in 2009. It also creates an alternate supervisor provision to allow a little more flexibility to meet licensing requirements. And in conclusion, again, on behalf of the board, I would just really extend our appreciation for this opportunity today, and I hope that the committee can support increased consumer protections for our vulnerable citizens, and more consistent public policy. And the board really sees this as an incremental, very positive change. Thank you very much to all the committee members. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Zachar-Pate. Are there questions from the committee? Sir Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, and I guess whoever would like to answer, what after 2016, what are the requirements? I guess we didn't go through that. I see a lot for grandfathering, but I only see a little bit for after 2016, so I'd like to know what that is.
Ms. Zachar-Pate.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach. After 2016, the licensing requirement would be specific to individuals who are employed by city and state agencies and these private nonprofits, and they would need to be licensed under two conditions and two conditions only. If indeed they were going to use the title of social worker, they would need to be licensed with the board. Or if that individual has a social work degree, an accredited social work degree, and will engage in social work practice, then they would need to be licensed with the board, just as a nurse or a physician or any other trained and licensed professional. So it would be limited to licensing being required under those two circumstances in those particular types of agencies.
Senator Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Fischbach, that language is on Section 1, Line 14. It talks about what has to be required after 2016. And again, remind that the delete all amendment does exclude the counties for various reasons. This did not come forward last year because there was still many more discussions occurring with the counties and getting agreement, and so it wasn't ready for prime time last year. But they have been working diligently to come to an agreement, and I'm sure the conversation will continue. However, the argument for the exempting the county worker is there is already a good appeal process in place with the Board of Social Worker. There was a question of adding cost to the county and to the different agencies, and then also some hiring challenges in Greater Minnesota. So that's why there is an exemption to the county.
Senator Mr. Fischbach. Chair and Senator Rosen, I've looked at the language on page one, and all that I can tell is, and tell me if I'm missing something, because there's some statutory references here, but it appears as though the statutory references on 116 are exceptions. Okay. But then the only thing that I can tell is that after 2016 is they will have to have a degree and then send their license fee into the board. They just have to graduate. Where are the other requirements, I guess? What are the requirements to be licensed? Because all I see is that they have to have a degree.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Ms. Kavanaugh or somebody from, because it would be in the statute here.
Well, those are exemptions, that's the way I read this.
Do we have any advice from counsel?
And Mr. Chair, maybe someone can just tell me, is the only thing they have to do is graduate and then send in their fee?
Ms. Zachary?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Fischbach, let me see if I can clarify that for you. Now, the area of the amendment that you were referencing on lines 1.114 and 1.23 essentially just clarifies the need for those individuals to be licensed under one of those two circumstances, if using the title or having the degree in practicing. So that sets the stage. Now, later in the bill, and it's one of the things I want to get my fingers on it immediately, if you would go back to, for example, subdivision 3.
What page?
I'm sorry, page 2. And subdivision 3, lines 2.20, and then further through the bill, you know, what you can see is that here is where it talks very specifically about the requirements that must be met during that grandfathering period for each of the four licenses, that you have your degree, it names and identifies what the degree can be, that there must be the BCA background check, that once licensed there is continuing education, supervised practice. Is
Mr.
that helpful?
Mr. Chair, and ma'am, I understand that that appears to be during the grandfathering period. Once we're done with the grandfathering period, I'm going to graduate in June of 2016.
Got it.
And I have a degree in social work. What happens then? I mean, because I understand the that's why I looked through. There's lots and lots of pages on the grandfather, and I understand the need for that. But what happens after that period expires?
Yes.
Ms. Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbacken, thank you. I think I really understand what your question is now. So the grandfathering period is specified in this particular area of the statute once the grandparenting closes. And remember that this is a time-limited two-year period. From that point forward, then it would be, I guess I would just say, the current sort of regular statutory requirements about licensing.
And what
and
I
at that point in time, thank you. At that point in time, what is required is a social work degree, either bachelor's or graduate, that is accredited by Council on Social Work Education. That gains you eligibility. Then you are required to take the national examination. Supervised practice applies to each and every license at different points in that license. And that is initial licensing. And then from there, there is a renewal mechanism put in place on a biennial basis whereby continuing ed is required, supervised practice is required. And I did also miss that important requirement initially, and that is that Minnesota BCA background check. So it's like essentially once the grandparenting closes, then we go back to the regular standard statutory requirements. So I hope that that is more clear.
So, Ms. Ackerman, just so that I understand, you're saying that those things you just mentioned, those criteria, are already in statute, already required?
Yes, that is correct, Mr. Chair.
And those are not going to change?
That is correct. That is correct. And those are in statute, and I believe the citation is 148E.055.
Okay. Senator Fischbach.
I believe that that is the case.
Mr. Chair, in Section 7, page 9, it does talk about what they have to do, the back check, the passing the licensure examination in 148E.055.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hayden, did you have a question?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. So I think what I was just trying to figure out is that there obviously is some problem or there's something that we're trying to fix. And I don't know. I think that that might help us to talk about what are we trying to fix here. So it sounds like, if I follow this correctly, that we have folks that are practicing social work without a social work degree, right? They may have a psychology degree or a sociology degree or whatever, and somehow they've gotten in the system and are practicing social work. So what we're saying is that we're going to grandfather in certain cases those folks who have been doing this work, but in 2016 moving forward, you must have a degree in social work or an MSW or a master's of social work. I mean, is that, because you're kind of going yes or no, is that what we're saying and that's what we're moving forward? I mean, I think part of what I'm trying to figure out is what are we trying to, we're addressing some issue here. And I don't know, Senator Rosa, Ms. Chair, if I really understand what the issue that we're trying to address, because there clearly is one based on all of this language and all of the consternation around the community. So maybe if we can help understand what is the issue we're trying to fix, and then what are the accommodations that we're doing for those already in the system, and then in 2016, what do we expect those that are want to be social workers, what they need to study and what the discipline needs to be.
Very good.
Thank you, Senator Hayden, for your question. Ms. Zacherpate?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, I'm happy to address that. The problem that exists today is that there is not a consistent public policy about who needs to be licensed in Minnesota to practice social work. There are clearly disparities and inequities. And because of that, because of the current licensing exemptions, what it really comes down to is that those consumers of social work services who are served by a person who is not licensed, which is permissible under current law, they are not afforded the same protections as a consumer who receives services from a licensed individual. And it comes down to two very specific things. If a social worker is not currently licensed, which is permissible under law in particular settings, that individual certainly would need to meet employment standards, but they would not need to meet the board's professional standards, that I have identified in terms of academics, examination, adherence to ethical standards, et cetera, et cetera. So they are not meeting the same standards. And very, very importantly, that consumer who is being served by someone who is not licensed does not have access to the board's independent complaint resolution process. When those consumers call us and say something has gone wrong, what we need to say to that person is there are still licensing exemptions. Let me verify if that person is in fact licensed and if we have any authority over that practice. And if we have no authority over that person's practice, and this happens, what we have to say to that consumer who has been harmed in some way is to say, we're sorry, we can't help you. We can't help you at all. And so that is the problem that we are trying to remedy. Now, knowing that with an initiative like this, when you are making changes in the workforce, the grandparenting really is pretty standard, and I think it's very necessary to balance regulation with market needs and get people into the system with still ensuring standards. From that point forward, when the grandparenting closes, what it means is that as of 2016, as I've said, individuals in these specified settings under the two conditions, using the title with the degree in practicing, will be required by law to be licensed. But that does not mean that every person who wants to serve in a social service capacity must have a social work degree. There is still room for other qualified individuals who might have a degree in sociology, voc rehab, psychology. If an employer would deem them qualified, they may still work in the market and serve clients, and they would not be required to be licensed. The board has jurisdiction only over the use of the title and people who have social work degrees and are doing social work in their jobs. Does that help, Senator Hayden?
That does, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Just one more question. Are there billing implications to being a social worker or an LSW or LSICW? So I'm trying to think about if I'm a provider of services and what is, and I didn't want to abide by this, why wouldn't I just go get a case manager, folk rehab, make up a different name, and still be able to provide the services? So there must be some implication that having a social worker allows you to bill or to recoup fees at a certain level based on what we understand that service is being provided. Can you, Mr. Chair, can you talk a little bit about that?
Ms. Zacherby.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, yes, definitely. Licensing, and this is not limited to the social work discipline.
Yes, no, I understand.
Licensing and having that license credential really does enable that individual and then therefore that individual's agency the ability to access third-party pay. Absolutely. That's a market issue that the board certainly has no control or authority over, but that is definitely one of the value addeds.
Yes.
That agencies have been clear about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Zacherby-Pate, who does this box out? I see people in the audience holding signs that say, ask me about OT, and I assume that's not overtime. I assume that's occupational therapist. How does that affect occupational therapists? And maybe, Mr. Chair, if we have some testimony from citizens, that we could find that out as well.
Ms. Zacherby.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I guess I would just say that I'm not quite sure that they are here related to this bill, but I would say that if someone is an occupational therapist, this does not box them out in any way, shape, or form. That individual is still able to practice as an occupational therapist, and that really doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of the Board of Social Work. You know, they would not need to be licensed if they're not using the title of social worker, and clearly with an occupational therapist training and degree, they, quite frankly, wouldn't even be eligible for social work licensing, and they could certainly practice as an OT. It would it would not box that individual out.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, and this is why it was not ready for prime time last year, because there is a tremendous amount of communication and making sure that everybody's comfortable with this going forward. So,
Mr. Chair, do we have somebody from the OT group that seems to be here? Are you here about this bill?
Senator Higgins, I did want to clarify, because I think Ms. Zuckerpate and maybe Senator Rosen, you testified earlier that, to your knowledge, there were no opponents or opposition to the bill. I just want to make sure if there are people here who are in opposition, be certainly happy to hear them.
That's right.
I don't see anybody approaching the table, so we'll assume you're correct. Are there other questions for Senator Rosen or the witness? Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if not, I was looking to Senator Hoffman. She looked like she had a question, but she's okay. Okay, then I would like to move that Senate file 753 as amended be recommended pass and move to the floor.
Senator Rosen, I do need to ask you to modify your motion slightly. I was informed after your conversation that we had earlier that the Judiciary Committee has requested the bill.
So
if you could amend your motion to refer to
Judiciary. I move that Senate file 753 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary.
Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rosen, for your diligence on this issue. I know you worked on it for a while. And Ms.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, committee members.
Next members, we're going to take up Senate File 726, Senator Sharon.
So they're all on my pile. So I keep trying not to knock them off the table.
Senate File 726. And then we went into the whole.
Thank you.
And we went into the rhetoric. And so you let the testifiers do a lot of the rhetoric.
Heck yeah.
Give the room a little chance to clear here before we start testimony.
All right.
Looks like we've got some of the movement settled down. Senator Sharon, What would you like to begin with?
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to present Senate File 726. And I think the first request I would have of the committee is to adopt the delete all amendment, the A5 amendment, which can be, if it may be in your materials already.
Yes, I think we have in the materials, but A5. I think we got a copy sent out on too. So I think we can do this as an author's amendment. Senator Sharon moves to amend Senate File 726 with the A5 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you very much. Then the second thing I'd like to do is draw your attention to some materials that are in your folder, along with the overview prepared by the Senate Counsel of the bill. You should have a copy of a fiscal note, and there should be with it a summary statement of what Senate File 726 does and helps the committee members understand who can enroll in medical assistance, employed persons with disabilities, what the benefits are, and what happens to a person with a disability on medical assistance without the employed persons with disabilities capacity. And then also on that sheet, what happens after 65 with some of the changes that are proposed in this bill. And I laid that out last year for this committee when we heard this bill for the first time.
You also will have a letter from the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. And those are materials that I think will be helpful for the committee members to review in understanding what Ken, as you listen to some of us discuss this, can sort of fold in on itself in complexity. So I would remind the committee that we did hear a bill related to medical assistance EPD last year. The amendment adds language to that, but the first part of the bill that we heard last year related to and was approved by this committee to allow persons on MAEPD to, after the age of 65, not comply with asset restrictions in relationship to medical assistance. This new bill, the amended bill, adds to that a removal of the age 65, which will to allow persons with disabilities to continue to work. So that's what the and also a request for a clear request that we begin to address this issue when the waivers are requested, federal waivers are requested to address this growing problem that we didn't recognize when we first developed the MAEPD program. We were not looking at the long lifespan of persons with disabilities and do any really long-term strategic thinking about how to deal with persons as they move towards this retirement age. I would defer to you, Mr. Chairman, if you would like us to be more specific about the details of the bill at this time, or if you would like to hear from our testifiers.
Well, I thank you, Senator Sharon. I appreciate, first of all, your work on this bill. I think it is an important issue, and I think you've done a great job with bringing this to the committee last year. And as members may recall, we did pass a version of this bill, but for a variety of reasons was not able to make it through the whole process. So I appreciate, Senator Sharon, you bringing it back. And maybe what we could do is see if there are – let's just take further testimony and then see if there are questions from members.
That would be great. First of all, I'd like to introduce to you someone that you're all familiar with, I'm sure, is Anne Henry is with me. She is a lawyer, and she's with the Disability Law Center.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We work with children and adults with long-term significant disabilities across our state. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm just going to briefly give you information about three areas. First, a little background on the medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities called MAEPD. Second, specifically what happens to people who turn age 65 after they've been working and saving. And third, reasons why, despite our deep budget problems that we have endured here, you should still hold this in very high priority. First of all, the overview. This program is a work incentive program, and it is for people who need medical assistance because of the significance of their disability. Their private coverage and their Medicare do not cover the kinds of things they need, such as a personal care assistant, some durable medical equipment, and sometimes ongoing mental health services. So people then have to qualify for medical assistance, which means that they have to follow the rules which require impoverishment. People have very limited amount of money, either 100% of the poverty level, or if they have $1 over, they have to spend down to 75%, and they can only have $3,000. If they work, however, MAEPD allows people to keep income, pay a premium, and other out-of-pocket costs. It also encourages people to save and save for retirement. This was authored in 1999 by then-Representative Kevin Goodnow, and as Senator Sharon said, we have been moving along since then with more people joining. Out of now about 95,000 people eligible for MA due to disability, we have approximately 8,000 people that are participating in this work incentive. What happens when people turn 65? Well, when people turn 65, this program ends, and that means they face impoverishment again. And you'll hear from people affected. People have had to spend their retirement savings in a month. and there just is no path for them to continue to be as independent as possible after they've worked. The bill itself, as Senator Sharon explains, would allow people, first of all, who do retire, to keep those savings so they can pay for their housing and transportation and food instead of have to apply for all the substitute programs that are out there because people can't really live on $680 a month. So that's one part of it. The other is we have plenty of people who would really like to keep working after 65, and after all, age of retirement for all of us is going up. So we need to be able to do that for these folks as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we have some other testifiers.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this point from members? Senator Sharon, I have on the list a couple other people that wanted to present. Could we invite them to come?
Please.
I have Jim Carlisle, Charles Van Heuvelen. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Van Heuvelen.
And Roxanne Severance. And if those folks are here and would like to come to the table.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Take me on. My name is Charles Van Heuvelen. I live up in the Highland District. And it's difficult for me to talk and to understand that. And I'm going to turn over to Senator Sharon, but I'd just like you to sit with, imagine 5 minutes if you we're sitting here, and I let cherish that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Heuvelen. Appreciate your taking the trouble to come down here this morning, particularly given the weather, and great to see you here. Thank you.
I have the honor of reading a statement that he has prepared, so I'll be speaking for you. I'm a lifelong St. Paulite who has a disability of cerebral palsy. I grew up in West 7th Street neighborhood and now live up the hill at Jefferson and Lexington. I work. I pay taxes. I have a mortgage, and I'm involved in my community. I need to tell my story not just for me, but because there are hundreds of working disabled Minnesotans who are caught in the same trap that I am in, being forced to lose their homes like I will. I'm currently eligible for the Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities Program, MAEPD, which allows me to access medical assistance while keeping enough of my earned income and assets to lead a decent life. I work in a school. However, under the present law, the day that I turn 65, I can no longer access MAEPD. And I will lose much of what I've worked to save for retirement, and I won't be able to keep much of what I earn each month, meaning it won't pay for me to keep working. During the time that I have been on MAEPD program, because it allows me to pay a reasonable premium, I do pay a premium to access medical assistance, while allowing me to save some money and keep much of my monthly income, I've managed to purchase my own condo, my own van, and I feel that I have become a good member and a participating member of my community. This has taken a lifetime to do, and now I and others like me are being told that because we're turning a certain age, we have to give it all up. This doesn't seem right. It just doesn't make sense. All that I am asking for here is be able to retain what I have earned and saved. I turn 65 in May and will lose access to MAEPD. Whether I continue working or not, in order to remain eligible for medical assistance, I'll be forced to only keep $677 a month of my income or pension, which I have paid into over the last 18 years. this is not enough for me to continue my mortgage payments, so I'll lose my condo. And I'll have to go into public housing or a nursing home. By creating MAEPD program, the legislature allowed the disabled population the opportunity to prove to everyone that they can work and be as independent as possible by letting us work and retain a good amount of assets and monthly income. Now, because we reach a certain age and need a certain amount of care, that we need to give up everything that we've worked for in order to access that care. These laws need to be changed and to be changed soon. We must let people keep what they have earned and saved. We can do this by allowing those who turn 65 and have been on MAEPD to keep their retirement or assets, and by seeking federal approval to allow persons over 65 to continue to access MAEPD. We need to let people continue to work if they wish. I like my job, and I want to keep on working. I don't want all the things that I value, especially my independence, to end simply because I'm turning 65. Charles Van Hevelen.
Thank you, Senator Rosen, and thank you, Mr. Van Hevelen, for bringing your testimony to the committee. We appreciate it. I believe we have Sir Sharon, two other people who wish to testify.
Is Jim coming next? Or?
Members, I will be reading a statement prepared by Mr. Carlisle.
Thank you. Could you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Ani Simons.
Ms. Simons. And Mr. Carlisle, I want to thank you as well for taking the time and the effort to come down here this morning, given the weather, and we appreciate very much your being here.
So on behalf of Mr. Carlisle, thank you for allowing my testimony to be heard. I'm a 75-year-old semi-retired tax accountant. Before age 65, I served the taxpaying public using the work-encouraging MAEPD program. Over my prime working years, your predecessors and perhaps some of you allowed me to become independent through your progressive legislation. I'm grateful to the legislators and my clients who gave me a chance to succeed despite my significant disability. Through state investments in my education and other things, I was able to earn a modest living plus employ one year-round and three part-time assistants during the tax season. We all paid taxes and contributed to the Social Security Administration. Later in my year, the state also furnished me with health care through the MAEPD program, which allowed me to keep most of my income until retirement age. When I turned 65, I became ineligible for MAEPD. While working with MAEPD, one can save up to $20,000 plus own a retirement account. When forced off this work incentive program, straight MA allows one to only have $3,000 in cash assets, including employee retirement plans, savings accounts, checking accounts, and other cash. My home is not fancy, but it is spacious enough to accommodate two individuals in wheelchairs. The problem is that we have a hard time affording the upkeep on our government limited incomes. High real estate taxes, homeowners insurance, and winter utility bills stretch our budget to the limit. Rising gasoline prices have forced us to leave our accessible van in the garage more, and instead we use Metro Mobility, which the state has to substantially subsidize. We would much prefer the independence of using our own funds rather than government assistance and subsidies. I receive $912 per month on Social Security and a small VA pension from my dad. MA assesses me a $332 spend down, allowing me just $580 a month to live on. Thus, the state takes over 36% of my meager retirement income, while most senior citizens living only on Social Security pay no income taxes, and retired Minnesotans with additional income pay no more than 7.85% in state income taxes. My accounting firm breaks even these days with less clients and higher expenses. There's no incentive to make a profit when 100% of it would go to the state. but I do enjoy the continuing personal contact with my lifelong clients and helping them deal with their tax issues. Denying retirement benefits to people with disabilities who earn them while on MAEPD is certainly an injustice, especially since much more effort is usually involved in their work activities. Policymakers have said they would like to keep people with disabilities in their homes and engaged in the community because it's better for their overall health. I hope this committee shares this viewpoint and will be supportive of any legislative measures necessary to extend the MAEPD program to disabled people of all ages. Thank you. Jim Carlisle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carlisle, again for coming to the committee and giving us your testimony. And Senator Sharon, do we have one other testifier?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. We have Roxanne Severns, who testified last year about having to spend down her retirement savings. She helped us last year when we first reviewed this legislation.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name's Roxanne Severns, and I'll give you the short version of my story. I realize time is of the essence here. I live in Minneapolis. I'm 68 years old. I was on the MAEPD program for many years while I worked. I paid into Social Security. I paid into all the things that you folks paid into, including a retirement fund. When I got to age 65, I was given 1 month to spend my entire money that I paid into for retirement income for approved items, not what I wish to. I now have a burial account. Does me a lot of good right now. But I did pay for my living expenses. I bought my own van. Right now, I'm still working. I'm 68 years old. I'm still working. I work for the Guthrie Theater. If there was any sense, any incentive to do so, I probably would work more. I was devastated to learn at age 65 I could no longer participate in MAEPD. Instead, I had to qualify for regular medical assistance, which meant that all my income, except $677 a month, would go to medical assistance. When I had to spend my retirement income in 1 month, I did buy supplies. I bought everything I could think of that I would need in the next few years because I knew I wouldn't have enough money to live on. Right now, I receive Social Security, which I paid into. I now pay $1,876 per month to medical assistance. I have $677 to live on for the month. I am now living in Section 8 housing, but I don't qualify for like energy assistance, food assistance, because they go by gross income, not how much money you have to live on, even though that money does go back to MA. Within this next year, I will probably lose my van because I won't have enough money to pay for insurance, licensure fees, gasoline, and so forth. And this means that I won't be able to spend Christmas with my family, the holidays, or to do anything other than where Metro Mobility goes. After MAPD, after 65, would allow people with disabilities to keep their families together, maintain their homes, and pay their way for a longer period of time. I'm also told that it's very difficult to move into Section 8 housing right now and almost impossible to get a two-bedroom apartment. So that isn't even You're going to send people to nursing homes again, and that's going to be a far higher price to pay than what keeping us are in our own homes and in Section 8 housing and so forth. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify to this committee. I was here last year again. Please, please make this go all the way. There's so many people and families that are really counting on you. And just about everybody has somebody in your district or that have had people with disabilities that have had to move to the city because of disability and access issues. And I appreciate your work, Senator Sharon. I'm a little nervous here. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ahrens, for your testimony and willingness to come back.
Oh, by the way, there was a big article in the Sunday paper about this, too. I would encourage you all to try and read that.
All right. Thank you. Senator Sharon, I have no one else on my list of presenters. I know from brief conversation before the committee convened that we do want to talk a little bit about the fiscal note. And members, you have a copy of that in your packet. And perhaps, I don't know if Senator Sharon, you want to lead us through that?
Okay, thank you very much. We just received the fiscal note this morning. This is a complex issue, and we really appreciate the department's work on this. It offered us the first opportunity, as you know, to go through assumptions in a fiscal note, and we discovered there may be some language changes that we could do, and I might amend the bill in the future in order to change these assumptions and to be able to offer other methodologies for achieving our goal than are assumed in this bill in order for us to be able to change the size of this fiscal note. So if you have more specific questions than that, I would defer them to Ann Henry. But what we're requesting with your permission, if this is your sense of direction, that that we're hoping that the review of the bill in policy, at least, is supported by the committee, and that you'll allow us, by laying it on the table, some time to go back and change, probably come back with an amendment to this bill that will have a better outcome in terms of the fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Yes, I appreciate your work on this, and I did understand that this was something you just saw this morning, and it's your desire to try to see if there are things that can be done to affect that. And I would be happy to lay this over for a bit, give you and others a chance to work on it. We are still working through the likelihood of a finance bill in this committee. I think we probably will have one, but we haven't made a final determination. But I would very much like to see this bill go forward. So I'd be willing to certainly do that. Sir Marty, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, and I haven't read the fiscal note yet either. I just, when I see the expenses when somebody loses their own housing and everything else, have trouble believing it's going to cost more. I assume that's because a lot of those additional expenses are in the fiscal note are federal expenses. So in effect, because we're only looking at the state expenses, that's why the fiscal note is so high, or could you briefly comment on it?
Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, I also have not totally absorbed the fiscal note, but I think, in fact, we know that the rules of doing fiscal notes do not take into account the other programs that people would have to access if they are not within the confines of the Department of Human Services. So federal funding for food stamps or other things like that people might access can't be accommodated in a fiscal note.
And you heard in the last testifier was talking about not the gross income being the number that's used for calculating eligibility for food stamps. Here's another issue that we might want to talk about further as we're addressing this bill, because it doesn't take into account this unique situation in which people are disabled, could continue working, and could possibly avoid additional expenditures, even though they're booked in somebody else's budget.
Right. Thank you. Are there other questions, Sir Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sharon, you know, I'm kind of happy to hear that this is going to be laid on the table to give you an opportunity to come back and talk about this some more. And, you know, if possible, when you come back, the questions that I have, and I'm not asking you to answer them today, would be, you know, questions concerning how much or how large of a pension would these folks be entitled to keep? How much can they have in savings? What is their income allowance? What are they entitled to or receiving from MA while they were involved in this program? It seems to me that there's got to be fairly significant benefit to the state of Minnesota if folks are working. And I would really like to be able to look at the numbers as they apply to this group of individuals if we allow them to continue on past age 65 as they have been doing up to age 65. So if you could do that when we come back to it, I'd really appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Newman. And I don't know if there is a sheet in the packet that may respond to some of the issues you've raised, Senator Newman. It's just a two sides, one page thing about current law. But I think you're raising very good points, and I think that if we can have a little closer look at the fiscal note and see what we can do to try to address that before we take it up again, that would be great. Other questions for Senator Sharon or the witness? Well, thank you, and thank you again, Senator Sharon, for your work on this, and I certainly hope that we can find a way to get this in a form to move forward. So thank you.
Thank you,
Ms. Henry.
And, this members, doesn't require a motion?
I think we can just lay it on the table or lay it over for consideration, and we can take it up whenever you're ready. But I would like to give you an opportunity. We don't have a whole lot of time, but Senate File 1721, if you're ready to take that up,
ready.
You can do that.
Thank you very much. What we are here is presenting Senate File 1721. And I think the first order of business would be to ask that the A1 amendment be distributed, and which is simply technical changes to the bill. And with your approval, I would move that amendment be accepted by the committee.
Right. Members, you should have a copy of the A1 amendment in your packet. And Senator Sharon moves as an author's amendment the A1 amendment to Senate File 1721. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much. I would also refer you to materials that we've provided for you that are in your packet. There is a summary of what is in Senate File 1721 that articulates the summary of the changes. It talks about how collaborative the groups have been in terms of working through this language, and I think you'll find that helpful. When you're looking at a thick piece of legislation. So I'm here to present this bill, which I really think in deference to the time that we have left in the committee, that I'll simply turn this right away to the experts to help you understand what the background is, what the context is that this comes from, and what it achieves. I just would highlight that the costs of it are assumed by the board through their licensing fees, so the fiscal note and related costs are not borne by our budget, that this is not changes. They are not, the committee does not have to be concerned about changing scope of practice, because this is about shifting language from one section of law into another statutory area and refining and synthesizing and placing it in a way where it can be dealt with more efficiently and effectively.
All right, thank you. And we have a witness. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Carrie Rexigal. First name K-A-R-I, last name R-E-C-H-T-Z as in zebra, I-G-E-L.
Thank you, Ms. Rexigal.
Rexigal.
Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Sharon, as chief author, and all members of the committee for considering our testimony here today. You already know my name. I think a little brief history and context for this great big bill that you have in front of you might be helpful. The Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy was created in 2003 to license and regulate professional counselors, professional clinical counselors, alcohol and drug counselors, and persons practicing under temporary permits. And in the year 2005, the alcohol and drug counseling program was transferred to the board from the Department of Health. And along with that program came a $1 million debt. And so this board has been working for the past 6.5 years to retire that debt. And some of the ways we have done that is to reduce the size of our staff, look at our processes, you know, with our constraints, with our budget, and with our staffing level. How are we gonna regulate the best we can? And so this bill, you actually saw the language and passed it in this committee last year, the Article 1 language on alcohol and drug counselors, and nothing has changed in Article 1. Article 2 has to do with housekeeping necessary changes for professional counselors. And I think you have a summary sheet. I can go over those housekeeping items if that's helpful. We are trying to eliminate reference to an obsolete exam. We are making some changes to continuing ed requirements. We're not lessening them, although we are trying to give our counselors a break, those who have to complete graduate credits. It's the only license that requires such a thing in the first 4 years of licensure. And finally, I've sort of lost track here.
Well, maybe, Ms. Rexico, I could just ask, to your knowledge, are there opponents or opposition to this change?
Mr. Chair, to our knowledge, there are no opponents to the bill. This language was heard in a couple of hearings in the House last year, and things that came forward then have been addressed.
Okay. And members, just for your reference, this bill has also been asked to be referred to Judiciary Committee, where there may be, I'm not sure what their interest might be, but I know some of the members serve on that committee as well. So if this were to pass, it would end up in the Judiciary Committee. Sir, sure.
Thank you. I find that an interesting request, but we can talk about that at another time. But I want to assure the committee that the Article 1 has been heard before. The bill and its origin, everything that's in its origin of this bill is already in statute or rule that's already in effect. We aren't creating an expansion of scope of practice. And the bill will make this the licensed addiction counselors, alcohol and drug counselors regulations similar to that of a professional counselor and other health services and licenses. That's what helps streamline and create some efficiencies for the board. And processes that were changed in here had license renewal, expirations, and voluntary termination of license. Those languages have been cleared up. And there's a request for a study to take a look at one of the issues raised in the House last year, which was whether or not we needed a tiered system, a gradation system in terms of levels of preparation for licensed alcohol counselors and how they ought to be treated differently or not treated differently.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think the reason they're referring all these bills to judiciary is to punish the three or four of us on both committees.
I'm sure, Senator Marty, that's not in the mind of the chairman of the committee. But
Here's privacy. That's what it did.
Senator Hayden, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about this in the House last year when I served. So I was trying to remember some of those questions. There was kind of an ongoing issue around the provisional license and when that grandfathered out for those who hadn't gotten their degree. They, in practice before, Mr. Chair, they had gotten their provisional license, and it was a time in which they needed to get their degree in order to become fully licensed LADCs. And so could you just address that, or if that's in this bill, or if I remember there was some consternation about when that date is and when it phases out, et cetera.
Ms. Rexigel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden. Yes, I recall that, and I recall you were at that committee hearing last year. And what the board did was restore the requirements for temporary permit holders and applicants to what is currently in Chapter 148C, what's currently in law already. And so it's back to the way it was. That's part of the reason for the tiered licensure study, is to see if any changes should be made into what's currently there. So nothing changed. There's no limit on when they have to do that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering the motivation behind licensing more people. Is there a billing issue? Are we having trouble with consumer complaints to the Attorney General's office? What is the reason for doing this?
I'll defer to that, but this is not an additional this is not a new license. It's moving them into and dealing with them in a different statute.
I misunderstood. I apologize.
That's okay.
Are there further questions for Senator Sharon or the witness? Seeing no further questions, I think we need a motion. Senator Sharon, would you like
yes,
to?
Yes. You have a suggestion for a motion.
All right. Senator Sharon moves Senate File 1721 as amendment be recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary Committee to give other members who are here a second chance to hear the bill. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. And members, before we leave, I just wanted to alert you. I got a message that our friend and our colleague, Senator Kubley, has had a issue and has been transferred to the hospital, and just wanted to let you know that and ask that you keep him in your prayers. As we all know that he is struggling with a condition that certainly our sympathies and our prayers are with his family. But just want to let you know that. And with that, one other thing. Yes. I also wanted just to alert you that as we go forward, we may have occasion to extend some of our meetings into the evening. We'll let you know, try to give you as much advance as we can. We may have a Friday meeting as well, but at this point we have nothing on the schedule, but I did want to alert you to that there is a likelihood, and we'll give you as much advance notice as we can. Thank you, and we are adjourned.